The Trumpet Daily Program begins right now.
Today's world news, what it means, where it's taking us.
I bring you the one and only possible message of world peace.
This is a message of hope, tremendous hope. And he said unto me, you must prophesy again.
And now, The Trumpet Daily with Stephen Flurry.
Hello again, everyone. Welcome back to the Trumpet Daily radio show. Well, if you're in America and you can manage to break free from the 24/7 coverage of Donald Trump's feud with the National Football League, you might be interested to know that over the weekend, there was a political earthquake in Germany. And if you're a student of Bible prophecy, then you know that this is pretty significant. So much for this supposedly being just another boring German election. Some of you may recall we've been talking about this in the weeks leading up to yesterday's election. Brad McDonald, Richard Palmer, and others speaking about how the general sentiment, at least judging by the coverage, some of the commentary, was that, well, this is just kind of a boring election, nothing really to report here. Angela Merkel is probably going to be reelected, so no big deal. Well, Ms. Merkel did win her fourth term in office, but by all accounts, yesterday was a disappointing day for her, to say the least, and for her party, the Christian Democratic Union, the CDU, and then the Bavarian sister party, the CSU. They came away with just 33% of the vote, which means that Ms. Merkel is going to have a very difficult time building a government coalition. Just a few years ago, I think it was 2013, the conservatives managed to take home about 41, 42% of the vote. And yesterday it dropped 8 or 9%. It dropped down to 33%. And it wasn't so good for the CSU party. The Bavarian party, we've talked on this program as well about zu Gutenberg coming over to Germany and campaigning for his party, the CSU, in support of Ms. Merkel. And so both really took a significant hit. And this was Stratford's take on it. The Bundestag that will emerge will be the most fragmented in decades. And there will probably be long negotiations to form the next German government. What does it mean when Germany's government is fragmented? Well, in the studio with us today, we have, speaking of Richard Palmer, we have Richard Palmer, who has been, since last night, all through this morning, he's been trying to digest so much of the news coming out of Germany to help for you and me and all of us to better understand the real significance of what happened or transpired in Germany yesterday. Welcome to the program, Richard.
Thanks for having me.
So I mentioned about Angela Merkel's party, the CSU, the CDU, but maybe you could just start by telling us how the other parties did and then the significance of what happened yesterday.
Well, basically, all the mainstream parties did badly. So for Angela Merkel's party, it was the worst result since 1949. I think it was Deutsche Welle that has talked about generally this level of victory or this low level of votes, you'd see a chancellor resign. But as they pointed right out, these aren't normal times for Germany. At the same time, you had the main left wing party; they got their lowest vote in post war history at just 20%. So a massive defeat for them. But then the big winners, or the big winner, was the Alternative for Deutschland, this new fringe party, never been in the German parliament before. Really the first time you've got kind of a proper right-wing party in the German parliament in Germany's post-war history. And they're not only in Germany's parliament, they are the third biggest party in Germany's parliament. They won 12.6, I think the latest projections show, of the vote. So they're just 7 or 8% behind the SDP there. just an unprecedented result. And that, I think, is the biggest thing that's kind of got everybody talking this morning.
Yeah, a couple of things that you had assembled this morning just from the press over in Germany and even some here in the UK. But this from Deutsche Welle, it says, in the past, speaking of the AfD, the Alternative for Deutschland party, in the past, AfD party members, many of whom are now virtually assured of Bundestag seats, have declared that the Constitution is not written in stone, demanded an end to the cult of guilt surrounding the Holocaust, warned against the creation of mixed peoples, and called Chancellor Angela Merkel and other leading mainstream politicians traitors to their people. So that's just a collection of some of the more extreme statements coming out of the AfD in recent years.
Yeah, I think one of the ones we drew attention to just from a week or two, right in the final run-up of the election, where one of their leaders said Germany has a right to be proud of what their soldiers accomplished during World War II, which is just an absolutely shocking statement. So you've got, I think there was one authority that said about those 90 MPs or 90 members of parliament that will be going into the German parliament from the AfD, they said about 34, 35 of those are far-right extremists.
Mm-hmm.
Now, there's already been a bit of drama in the AfD just this morning. The party's chairwoman, Frau Petri, basically quit the party this morning. She disagrees with some of the more right-wing elements in that party.
Right.
So there is kind of a spectrum in there. But you could see even perhaps after she quits, the party drifting even further to the right.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, and as far as the coalition, maybe you could explain. Mm-hmm. Previously, Mr. Schulz's the Liberal Democrat Party, they were allied with Ms. Merkel's group. Is that correct? Or
that's right. Yes.
Okay, and then coming out of yesterday, with only 21% of the vote, he declared that they're not going to have a coalition government with Ms. Merkel. And so, what does this mean?
Well, it puts Angela Merkel in a very tough spot, really, because you know, typically when you're forming a coalition, you want to be able to have a couple of approaches and you kind of, you know, you negotiate with both groups and you kind of say, well, if you don't give me a good deal, I'll go over to these guys. She's now stuck in the spot where as long as the SDP stick to that, and I think they probably will, they just, you know, being in coalition with Angela Merkel killed them. That's what led to them having such a record low result. I don't think they've got any incentive to go back into government. They know if they do, it'll probably be even worse next time around. So that just gives German Chancellor Angela Merkel one option. And it's not a great option. It's what's known as in Germany, the Jamaica Coalition, because the colours of the different parties that make up of it are the colours of the Jamaican flag. There's the Christian Union parties with the black colour, the Green Party, which has the colour green, logically enough, and then the pro-business Free Democrat Party that goes with a yellow colour.
Mm-hmm.
And so it would require these three parties, the FDP, which is generally considered to the right of Angela Merkel's, and the Green Party is obviously quite far to the left of Angela Merkel.
Right. And Mr. Schulz's group says no to the coalition. And then Ms. Merkel has said no to the AfD.
Right.
So what are her options?
Yeah. So this Jamaican coalition is the only option, working with three parties.
Okay.
The other party in Germany's parliament is the Left Party. And that's kind of like the AfD, but on the left.
Right.
It's the remnants of Germany's, East Germany's communist government. They're radically left-wing, and everybody said they won't work with them either.
Mm-hmm.
So the only viable coalition that's there is this Jamaica coalition. And Germany hasn't had a three-party coalition since the 1950s. They are unstable. You've got you've got to kind of reconcile multiple parties. Neither of these parties are going to be in a mood for compromise. The FDP have been in coalition with Angela Merkel before, in Angela Merkel's second government. She was in coalition with the FDP, and it killed them then. After that time in coalition, they did so badly in the next election that they didn't get any, no seats in the Bundestag, no seats in Germany's parliament.
Mm-hmm.
So they're not going to be easy to deal with. She's got to give them a lot of concessions if she's going to get them in the government. And then at the same party, most Green Party members say they don't want to be in government either. They would rather be in opposition.
Mm-hmm.
So they're going to be hard to get on side. And at the same time, you're trying to build this coalition with the FDP that are pro-business, low regulation, low taxes, that kind of thing. And then the Green Party that's almost the exact opposite.
Right.
Lots of government regulation, protecting the environment, etc. So That's why I think Stratfor's saying it's probably going to be a long time to get a coalition together. Even if she does get a coalition together, it just takes one party throwing a temper tantrum or deciding they don't like how things go, or just that it's electorally beneficial for them to torpedo it, and things can fall apart. So it looks, I mean, a lot of people are talking about how Germany now looks set for a very unstable government at a time where everything in the world is being more, you know, being more
very
dangerous.
Unstable. Yeah.
Yeah.
Yeah, the I think you had commented on his Trumpet brief, by the way. We've got a Trumpet brief that Richard's put together that's going to be going out later today. Hopefully we'll be able to post some of the content from that brief on the website as well. But in this brief, I think you've mentioned just how long this could potentially take, a few months even, perhaps longer, for her to even patch together some kind of a coalition.
Right. I think people are saying they expect it to happen by about mid-November.
Right.
I'm not sure if there's any constitutional limit onto how long they can have these negotiations.
And is it possible that she doesn't even form a coalition, that she's sort of the minority or one of the, I guess, how would that work if she can't patch it together?
Yeah, she said she doesn't want to form a minority government. So, okay. Really, she's left herself no options other than this coalition. And if not, then we're in an unstable territory.
Yeah. Deutsche Welle had this to say. This election sent a clear message. No more business as usual. And it had two clear losers, the Social Democrats or the SPD and Chancellor Angela Merkel. It says that the SPD slipped to a historic low, 20%, and Merkel's Christian Democrats, CDU, together with its Bavarian sister party, the CSU, lost around 8%. But it says further on here, this is a historic turning point. And I think you also included the quote from Bild, the German publication that referred to this as a political earthquake. And then the co-leaders of the Greens movement said that there were now Nazis in parliament. So it's pretty, I mean, some crazy statements coming from the press and also from the opponents of the AfD.
Yeah, we really are in uncharted territory. I mean, we're talking about what happens if Angela Merkel doesn't get this coalition together. And there is a process laid out in the German constitution, but it's never been used before. That's kind of how unusual some of this is. So if they don't get a coalition together, then it would be an attempt to have a minority government, which, as you say, you've got the AfD in parliament for the first time. It's an unstable parliament as it is. That is not a great option. And then it comes down to, if Parliament passes a motion of no confidence, you could be into fresh elections or something like that. But Trumpet editor or contributing editor Brad McDonald has made the point quite a few times that Germany is normally a beacon of stability, that you look at some of these countries like Italy that almost have a new prime minister every year, whereas Germany kind of gets a new prime minister or a new chancellor every decade or two.
Right.
So it's not a country that's used to dealing with this kind of political instability. So it will be really interesting to see how this plays out. And I think one thing that's interesting as we watch this play out is really Angela Merkel owns this defeat.
Right.
It's a repudiation of not just her, but her entire strategy. Her whole way of doing government for the past 13 years or so has been to kind of move to the center, to do a deal with the party, or to kind of steal some of the policies of the party to the left of her. And it's completely destroyed the Social Democrats. But at the same time, people have got to be sitting there thinking, if we hadn't have done that, all those 12.6% of people that voted for the alternative for Deutschland, most of them would have been voting for us.
Right.
And this election would have been a cakewalk.
Right.
And so,
what does it say about the sentiment among Germans where 13% of the people turn out, knowing full well that AfD is not going to win, but they just cast their vote for AfD to basically make a statement that we don't want to be a part of Ms. Merkel's party anymore. She's been too much in the center or whatever.
Yeah, it does show a huge level of dissatisfaction. And that's one of the big reasons why people are so surprised with the AfD's level of victory. They assumed that you'd have these people that fine would vote for the AfD in local elections, but then would say when it came to the national election, well, I want to make sure that we don't get the Social Democrats in power. I'm going to come back and I'm going to vote for the Christian parties. But this shows that they're too angry to think like that. And they probably view Angela Merkel as little better than the Social Democrats at this point. That, you know, well, what difference does it make if it's Angela Merkel or if it's going to be someone from the left? They're going to do the same kind of thing. So, yeah, and one thing I think it also shows is just the region. If you look at the regional votes for the AfD, it's also really interesting. So, for example, in East Germany, the majority of East German men voted for the AfD. Mm-hmm. Number one party, most popular party for men living in East Germany. So there's certain regions of Germany where you just have a huge level of anger and dissatisfaction at the current government.
Yeah, and overall it was like they were second.
Second,
they were
right.
Even ahead of the Social Democrats in East Germany. Yeah. How does this impact Ms. Merkel's party and then the Bavarian sister party? Because there has to be a lot of people in those parties, even prominent people in those parties that are very dissatisfied with her leadership. It's hurting their party. I mean, you mentioned how it hurts the Social Democrats, but it hurts their party too with only 33% of the vote.
Right, yeah, the CSU had it was a very bad night for them as well, or very bad day for them as well. And people are already talking about now, okay, watch for these parties to shift to the right. Bruegel think tank wrote about that. Politico was writing about that. Politico wrote that conservatives in Merkel's bloc, especially the Bavarians, that's the Christian Social Party, are already whispering, "I told you so." Look for that to continue and for the Chancellor to inch to the right on migration and questions related to German identity. And in so many ways, it's a no-brainer. There's 12.6% to the right of us. We didn't win very many people by moving to the left. Let's just go back to the right. We'll get some of those people back on board and we can win this.
Yeah. And of course, this is what the trumpet has been saying all along, that it's just going to take that special leader, that strong man from Daniel 8, to come along and to rally everyone behind his leadership. I think it's interesting, though. I mean, again, I don't think we've talked much about this potential leader emerging from the AfD. I don't think any of us really think that will happen. But it is interesting in the short term here just to see how this does significantly amplify the AfD message. How does, you mentioned gaining those 90 seats in the Bundestag out of something like 600 and whatever, how does that boost the party, the AfD, which to this point has won in a lot of smaller elections, 8, 10, 12% of the vote. But now that they have seats in the Bundestag, what does it do for their party?
It's a major symbolic victory, but then it's going to have some big practical impact. The Deutsche Welle, they wrote, in a nutshell, things are about to get a lot nastier. You can imagine what German parliament's going to be like now. You saw AfD supporters when Angela Merkel showed up, they'd show up to throw rotten tomatoes at her. Now they're leaders that think the same way. I mean, they're not going to be able to bring rotten tomatoes into the parliament, but they're going to be booing, they're going to be shouting, they're going to be jeering. You can think about what that's going to do to the atmosphere there. And then now their leaders will be standing up in parliament, which will then be those speeches. You'll see those, Germans will see those on the nightly news. They'll have a much bigger presence. The AfD will be much kind of like, they'll no longer be this slightly weird fringe party that we don't necessarily hear much about. They'll be the party that's on our TV every night.
Right. They're one of the big three. They're one of the big three now.
So their spokesman, we've been talking about how Karl Theodor zu Guttenberg was invited on to give comment to the debate between the chancellor candidates. Well, you're going to see more and more AfD spokesmen at those kind of debates, at those kind of panel discussions. That would be the normal thing to do, to have someone from the AfD sitting down discussing the news on your program. So, yeah, it's going to give them a lot more visibility and a lot further reach.
Right. Deutsche Welle said this, "What the AfD will have is a soapbox. Beyond the considerable speaking time the party will enjoy in the next Bundestag, political talk shows, like Richard was just saying, political talk shows and other institutions of German political culture will now have no choice but to give spokespeople for the far-right party a platform that will make the tone of German politics far less measured, far more coarse and cutting than it is now." Some good points brought out there by Deutsche Welle. Over at The Times here in the UK, it says, "The far right stormed into the German parliament for the first time in more than 50 years yesterday as it capitalized on fears about the influx of migrants under Angela Merkel," it says, "who held on for the fourth term as chancellor." Talks about 13% of the vote, getting 90 seats in parliament. And then it talks about just how devastating the loss was for the conservatives who came through with just, as we've said, just 33% of the vote. So you say in your trumpet brief that there's a good chance now, I guess you've already touched on it, but if you wanted to elaborate further on just the impact that the AfD's success can have or will have on Ms. Merkel's party and then also the Bavarian sister party, you think it's definitely going to go more to the conservative side.
I think so, and you've got to remember, now, Angela Merkel is coming up on setting the record for the longest running German chancellor ever. I think she's about to beat Otto von Bismarck for that title if she were to keep going and serve out this full term. So everybody's thinking about, well, who do we want to replace Angela Merkel? And so you know they've got to be looking to the right wing now, especially the CSU. That's one of the Franz Josef Strauss, who is just really influential in the thinking and just the whole culture of that party. The thing he always got back to was, look, our strategy has to make sure that there's no party to our right. We need to make sure we're always the most right-wing party in any election. And he generally won more than 50% of the vote with that strategy. It proved successful for decades. And so that's going to be a huge and urgent priority for the CSU to get back to that as soon as they're in power. And I think we can expect more sniping from Horst Seehofer, much more criticism of Angela Merkel coming from the CSU, more putting forward of right-wing programs. But then also then for the CDU, in years past, you have almost an alternation. They take it in turns, or sometimes you get a CSU leader leads the joint ticket for the two Christian parties, the Christian mm-hmm. Democratic Union, the Christian Social Union. They work together. The CSU only runs in Bavaria. The CDU only runs outside Bavaria. So, for example, several years ago, you had the CSU leader, Edmund Stoiber, leading the ticket for the whole group. And so I'm sure this has got to get people thinking the CSU brand is more right-wing than the CDU brand is. We need to move our party to the right. Their leaders have already started doing that. You know, they were criticizing Angela Merkel and her immigration policy for the last year or two. Maybe we should have someone from the CSU party lead us. Maybe we need to give them more prominence. Mm-hmm. I could see people thinking that way, but I think definitely people are going to be saying we need a replacement for Angela Merkel. Her entire way of doing things has just failed in this election. We need to move to the right.
Right. One of the things you mentioned last night when you emailed me about just some of your initial reactions to the election was that if you go back and look at the Trumpet magazine from 20, 25 years ago, where we were talking about this reemergence of the far right, we played a clip from Mr. Armstrong on a program we recorded last week where he talked about these 10 kings that come together and the strong man that leads them, how it's going to be fascist at its core. And you said last night that if we were to go back and look at some of our writings and just try to view them the way that the casual reader would view them that was not in the know as far as Bible prophecy goes, that it would have just seemed so ridiculous. I just flipped through, following what you said last night, I just flipped through the first few pages of Germany and the Holy Roman Empire. This is a booklet that we first put out in 1998, so it's nearly 20 years old. And the very first chapter is the resurgence of Nazi Germany. And as I was looking at that this morning, I thought, yeah, in 1998, I'm sure there were plenty of people that might have read that or looked at that headline and thought, you know what, there's no way. Look at the government. Look at the coalitions that are there. Look at the Bundestag. There's no way that the far, far right could ever find a place in German politics today. And so what we did in this article is we talked about, well, what the Allies were saying following World War II and how that they needed to rid Germany of Nazism entirely, and then how Germany reemerged from that due to the Marshall Plan and America building them back up and so on. And we mentioned in this article that Nazism did not die, and we tie in a prophecy in Revelation 17 that says that they're going to go underground and then reemerge at the right time. And now you see all of this happening. I mean, it really does bring so many of these prophecies to life, and even what we talked about, it wasn't with you, but Brad McDonald was in here a couple of months ago with Nicholas Frank, and he was sounding the alarm about how that the German people have never, ever really repented of what they did during the World War II era. So just a lot of prophecies that really are coming to life. As I said there at the top, it's a shame when you just see how distracted so many of our people are with other things. When you have these kinds of significant developments going on in the world. Well, with respect to your trumpet brief, are there any other points that you can tell our listeners about that will be coming out later today in the trumpet brief, or have we pretty well covered what you're going to be writing about this afternoon?
Well, I think we have pretty well covered it. I think the only other fairly substantial thing I mentioned in that brief is I just drew attention to Mr. McDonald's trumpet brief from last week, where he had a trumpet brief that he sent out talking about the AFD and pointing to Carl Theodor zu Guttenberg, this individual that we've pointed to for about, I think, 8-9 years or so as being somebody who follows the tradition of Franz Josef Strauss and Edmund Stoiber, someone who could well be this coming strongman of Germany. But in that trumpet brief, he pointed to him and talked about how he could be the ideal antidote to the rise of the Alternative for Deutschland. And you know, he made quite a few points about exactly why, about how he has been talking about the same talking points that the AFD has been making. He's been talking about the dangers posed by Islam and by mass immigration. And you've got to think, after this election, Germany's leaders from all parties, not just the CDU, but from all parties, are looking for an ideal antidote to the rise of the AFD.
Right.
And so, yeah, that's definitely definitely someone to keep watching.
Yeah, and speaking of some of the things we were writing about and talking about last week, we did have a pretty significant campaign going on the website to just draw more attention to some of these stories in the lead up to the German elections yesterday. And I think our listeners would be interested to know that, as I emailed to some of you this morning, last week we had our highest amount of traffic at the website since, I think it was March of 2014. So again, some of that does stem from the fact that we were out promoting those articles like Brad McDonald's and some of the things that you were writing. But it is nice to see, even all the way through yesterday — Sundays are typically a lower day of traffic, but that turned out to be our highest day for the week yesterday, Sunday. And all totaled, as I say, it was our best week since March of 2014. So in the days ahead, maybe we could conclude by you telling us what it is that you think you'll be looking for or observing maybe most in the days and weeks ahead as Ms. Merkel goes about trying to form her coalition.
Yeah, this is something I could see us having quite a few different articles over the weeks ahead on different facets of this election. I think, you know, dissatisfaction in the political class has got to be a big thing. You know, people are wanting for a big break. You can see even dissatisfaction even with democracy itself, and that's something we've pointed to for a long time, that this coming European power won't be democratic. I think one of the big things that we're watching is the makeup of the coalition. So, you know, how stable does it look like it's going to be? What concessions have been made? Is this something? Because if you could see how having an unstable coalition could even just build to a much bigger, much more serious political crisis in Germany. If you just have a government that can't react while lots of things happen around it, while, you know, the euro crisis keeps rumbling on, and the euro took a major dive this morning after as the results came out and as the markets opened. So that will be one thing to watch. Who gets what cabinet positions will be another thing to watch. We mentioned zu Guttenberg. There was a lot of talk before the election about him potentially getting a cabinet position. It'll be very interesting to see if that happens. Just the talk within the Christian union parties about which direction they go from here. And then Germany's role on the international scene, mm-hmm. and how they deal with things like the Middle East, with the euro crisis. You've got Europe had a whole bunch of things on the to-do list that they wanted to look at urgently. Brexit. Emmanuel Macron had a whole bunch of major reforms that he wanted to implement, reforms that would basically transform Europe into a super state. Mm-hmm. You've got Donald Trump and Europe's relationship with America. And these have all been kind of sitting on the to-do list, waiting for Germany's election to be over, waiting for Germany to have, okay, as everyone expected, Angela Merkel stable in charge, we can get on with things. That's not going to happen now. So what happens at a European level, and do these crises just continue to build?
Yeah. A lot to keep track of. Well, Richard, we thank you for coming in today to update us on the very latest regarding the German elections, the political earthquake in Germany that happened over the weekend. You're listening to Stephen Fleury and Richard Palmer for this first segment, and this is the Trumpet Daily Radio Show. If you'd like to email the program, you can send comments to td@kpcg.fm. We'll be right back.
This is KPCG-FM, and this is the Trumpet Daily. Herbert W. Armstrong described Germany's devastating destruction in 1944 and 1945 as one of the worst beatings ever administered to any nation. Western leaders from both sides of the Atlantic assured our peoples that a demoralized Germany would never again be able to disturb the peace of the world. But while Washington and London were promising that German militarism would never again be able to strike, Herbert Armstrong was warning the world of one final resurrection of a German-led Holy Roman Empire. Only a very few listened. Mr. Armstrong said German industry and the German people's willpower and determination to work, produce, and organize was the very heart and lifeblood of all Europe.
The nations of Europe want to unite. They just don't know how to do it.
He said the prostrate body of Europe could not come back without the leadership of a revived and vigorous Germany.
And the economic and the military body that is to rise up and to restore the Roman Empire, the thing that we least suspect here in the United States, it cannot rise up without its heart. And its heart is in Germany.
The world is witnessing history repeat itself one more time. Request Germany and the Holy Roman Empire for more on this important subject. The Trumpet Daily Radio Show airs every morning at 7 a.m. Central Time on KPCG 101.3 FM in Edmond, Oklahoma.
And I will tell you, the world is starting to respect the United States of America again.
That's U.S. President Donald Trump speaking Friday night in Huntsville, Alabama. That was a political rally for Luther Strange, who's, I think he's running as the Republican to fill the vacant seat, or the seat left vacant by Jeff Sessions down in Alabama. And so he talked about the United States gaining respect. And he talked about unity, about the United States coming together following some of these natural disasters. And then, as you probably know, if you were in the United States or anywhere near it over the weekend, he went on a tirade against the National Football League. Here's a little bit of what he said on Friday night, clip four.
Luther and I and everyone in this arena tonight are unified by the same great American values. We're proud of our country. We respect our flag. Wouldn't you love to see one of these NFL owners, when somebody disrespects our flag, to say, get that son of off the field right now. Out. He's fired. He's fired.
There he is about halfway through his speech talking about the NFL. I mean, an issue that pretty much was dying down. Colin Kaepernick, the one that got it all started, I guess, last year, he's no longer in the NFL. And there were just a few, I think two or three a week maybe, that were taking a knee or sitting on the bench before the game during the national anthem. But after that, after picking a fight with the NFL and also the NBA to some extent, now President Trump has the whole sports world in the United States against him for the most part. And everything, notice how everything just becomes politicized. Pretty much in the United States right now, it's all about the culture wars. Nothing else matters. Certainly not if it's in Germany. I mean, maybe a little bit about North Korea. We'll get to that in a second. But nothing else matters. And who knows what's all going on behind the scenes, whether the president meant to say this or not. I mean, some have written about how critical he was, what was it, earlier this year or last year, of President Obama for meddling in sports. I think he had a tweet himself, President Trump, about how that they have a right. Free speech. I mean, they can do what they want. Doesn't make it right. It doesn't make it something that he supports. But here, when he comes out that strong, even using profanity, you can predict. You could have just predicted what kind of reaction there would be, particularly with the media, but even among the athletes. And what did it expose? It exposed how deeply divided the United States is. Even in the same speech where he's talking about how united we are in our respect for the flag and our pride for the nation. And then you see on Sunday, deep, deep division. Some teams, half were kneeling, half were taking a seat, half of them were standing, with some had their hands on their chest. In the case of Pittsburgh, I think the entire team, the Steeler team, was in the locker room, except for one. He came out, a former Army veteran. He comes out, he can't stomach staying inside while the national anthem's going on, so he comes out. His team didn't know about it. They thought they were all going to stay in the locker room together. In New England, you had quite a few people take a knee or sit down, and their own fans in New England were booing them. New England's not exactly a stronghold for conservatives. I thought it was interesting, too. Hear that statement. Mr. Trump pours fuel on the fire Friday night and talks about how much respect we're getting from the world at large. The world's starting to respect the United States of America again. And the very first football game on Sunday morning, what happened to be one that took place right here in the UK. It was between the Jaguars and the Ravens. And so when the national anthem goes, as you saw all over the rest of the United States, as soon as the U.S. anthem starts, you have half the team sitting down or taking a knee in London. And then what was even more remarkable is following that, they played the British national anthem, and then everyone stood up and saluted it. They can salute the anthem of a foreign country, which you certainly should, out of respect. But yet the national anthem of the United States, and so many of President Trump's enemies are just now looking at that flag as if it represents the Trump administration. Deep, deep divisions. And yet if you continue listening to that clip, I mean, he goes on for another minute or two on the subject, and then at the end of it, those in that room, I mean, he's playing to the base. And they're wildly cheering down in Huntsville. They're cheering. They're chanting USA, USA. How much longer is this going to hold? I mean, the point I made earlier about just being oblivious to what's happening in the world, but even leave that aside, look at the deep, deep division. And already we've seen these atrocious acts of violence in Charlottesville, in Dallas, and you could just go right on down the line. That respect for the flag, that respect for America's history, that pride that used to hold the United States together. Events that would bring everyone together. There are no longer events like that. As I say, everything is politicized. Ezekiel 5, we've talked about it so many times before. Ezekiel chapter 5, where it talks about a third of our people, a third, dying even before the attack and the captivity, all these things that are prophesied in Ezekiel and elsewhere. So you see this deep division, and then you see these this political earthquake in Germany, and all this fiery rhetoric between the president and the leader of North Korea. Michael Dougherty had a piece at National Review following all of these protests over the weekend. He said, "I don't mean to say that symbols, gestures, ceremony, and protests are unimportant, but this is the sort of outrage news cycle that seems likely to appear in the history books as a way of demonstrating how distracted or innocent we were while some great national challenge or calamity was well on its way to crashing in on us." I mean, it is going to crash upon us. And it's not just going to be from the outside. It's coming from the inside, too. And that's what this past weekend shows. It's difficult to watch the bitterness. And then anything that throws salt on the wound, then to double down and to reinforce your position just that much more strongly. And everyone has such a strong opinion, when it comes to the culture wars at least. Meanwhile, you have so many of these other stories, as I say, that barely even get much attention. And if the situation with North Korea gets any attention whatsoever, it's just because, well, here again, President Trump is saying things that he shouldn't be saying. And I'm sure there is a case to be made for some of the statements that he makes. But still, this is real. This is real. We're talking about nations with nuclear weapons. We're talking about nations with the technology to kill millions of people. What will people be saying or demonstrating or protesting when the calamity, the real calamity, comes crashing in on us? Well, just to carry on with a couple more statements from that speech, you're familiar with the UN speech that the president gave last week, calling out North Korea and Iran. As I said last week, I mean, this is a very different president than the one that filled that office before January of this year. Here's what he had to say Friday night, again, at that Huntsville rally about the dictator in North Korea. This is clip two.
Little Rocket Man, we're going to do it because we really have no choice. We really have no choice. Now, he's talking about a massive weapon exploding over the ocean, Pacific Ocean, which causes tremendous calamity. Where that plume goes, so goes cancer, so goes tremendous problems. And I want to tell you something, and I'm sure he's listening because he watches every word, and I guarantee you one thing, he's watching us like he never watched anybody before. That I can tell you. That I can tell you. And maybe something gets worked out, and maybe it doesn't. Personally, I'm not sure that it will. Other people like to say, oh, we want peace. You know, they've been saying for now 25 years, oh, we want peace, we want peace. And then he goes and just keeps going, going, going. Well, maybe something gets worked out, and maybe it doesn't. But I can tell you one thing, you are protected, okay? You are protected. Nobody's gonna mess with our people. Nobody is gonna play games. Nobody is going to put our people in that kind of danger. Nobody.
That's the U.S. president again Friday night in Alabama saying that nobody's going to put us in danger. He'll deal with this threat. It remains to be seen how this will play out, but I would just refer you to the latest coworker letter that my father sent out. I think it has the date September 13th. So very recent, and he refers to his forthcoming new book called Nuclear Armageddon Is at the Door. I mean, once the button is pushed, once the bombs start to drop, there's no going back. And there's thousands of them on this earth today. This is of much greater concern. It should be. Than what someone does or doesn't do before a sporting event. My father writes in the coworker letter, this prophecy is racing toward being fulfilled. He's referring to the prophecy in Matthew 24 and Luke 21, Mark 13, the Olivet prophecy. Great tribulation. My father says, we see the danger posed by the North Korean nuclear threat, making matters far more dangerous is the fact that this nation has repeatedly been shown to be colluding with Iran on its weapons of mass destruction. Here's the real story of collusion that ought to be getting more publicity, more coverage, more investigative reporting. North Korea's collusion with Iran. He says we need to look at these developments in light of Christ's prophecy, as well as the many other prophetic biblical passages foretelling nuclear warfare in our day. We talked about some of this last week. The Great Tribulation, then the Day of the Lord, all of that preceding the return of Christ to this earth. Then my father makes this statement. He says, the Bible's prophecies show that, in a sense, the North Korea crisis is a massive distraction from the real threat posed by China and Russia. These powerful Asian nations are the only reason North Korea is able to operate so freely. And Bible prophecy shows that they pose a threat many times greater than the one from North Korea. North Korea is just a drop in the bucket. China and Russia, I mean, that's the real threat. And then you add to that, this could factor into prophecy heavily too. This collusion between North Korea and Iran. If Iran gets its hands on a nuclear bomb, but look at these emerging threats all around the United States. Russia, China. President Trump had some nice things to say about China in that same speech in Huntsville. Hoping, of course, that China can apply pressure. What we're heading for, though, is a trade war, initially, before an all-out hot war. And it was interesting this morning in Asia Times, this story was handed to me as well about the possibility of a trade war between China and the U.S. And as you know from what President Trump has said in the past, and as he said all up until the election last year, the campaign season, he kept saying over and again that the U.S. had the power position regarding any possibility of a trade war with China, indicating that the U.S. could destroy China's economy in just overnight. But as it points out in the Asia Times, it says that it could, this spat with North Korea, that it could trigger a global economic and geopolitical tsunami, possibly sending the U.S. economy into a repeat of the 1930s era Great Depression, while at the same time raising geopolitical tensions. It goes on to talk about what President Trump has boasted, how that we, again, have the power economically to bring China down. It says further on in the article, so why is President Trump, through his Treasury Secretary, Steve Mnuchin, threatening to stop trading with nations, that is China, to do business with that do business with North Korea? One major reason may be that some in the U.S. believe that China can be coerced into supporting the U.S. hardline policy against Pyongyang because a trade war could topple the communist regime in Beijing. But as this article goes on to bring out, is China really in that bad of a position? And what about the United States? It gives some fascinating statistics about China's huge domestic market. I mean, this is a nation with a population of 1.35 billion people. Supposing there is a trade war, what about all of those things that the Chinese economy produces? Well, they've got quite a few consumers right there in their own nation. The point being, how badly do they need the United States and all the consumers of the U.S. I mean, obviously, the enemy nations of the United States are going to be, they're going to be doing everything that they can to make money off the United States, off the U.S. consumer for as long as it's possible. But once it doesn't benefit them, and not just in the economic sense, but geopolitically as well, you'll watch and see. We've been talking about this as well, even recently. The coming trade war and the United States being frozen out of all of these trade arrangements between Asia and Europe and Latin America, Africa. Well, in that coworker letter, my father also spent some time on the disasters, just pounding the United States. $1 billion disasters, something like 11 of them now, just this year. The most recent ones, of course, being the two hurricanes, but then there's all the wildfires as well. My father says, since July 7th, our nation has suffered through record-breaking hurricanes, floodings, and fires. After an abnormally wet winter, many were lulled to sleep, thinking we would have a less devastating fire season. Not so, my father says. Fires are burning through our cities and mountains, not only in the U.S., but also in Canada. He said, we routinely see extreme crises shortly before the fall holy days. Why is that? That's the fall holy days. We had the Feast of Trumpets last week. The Day of Atonement's coming up this weekend. After that, the Feast of Tabernacles. Then the Last Great Day. And a lot of times, he's right, a lot of times in the lead up to those days, we see some crazy things going on in the world. Why is that, he asks. It shows God's people and some in the world the urgent need for what these holy days picture. He says this mad world is about to exterminate itself. And these fall holy days picture a new civilization ruled by Jesus Christ. You see, it's the darkest hour right now for this world. And yet, what is the real hope for the whole world? It's what God's church is doing today, and it's what God observes, or God's people observe, during these fall festivals. My father says, in the world's darkest hour, God is revealing an imminent future full of light and hope. We see this dying civilization filled with catastrophe, about to be replaced by the most inspiring civilization ever seen on this earth. It's a message you see over and again in the Bible. On Friday's program, I went through Joel 2 with you. At the end of that chapter, it talks about God pouring out His Spirit over all the earth, and that is coming. That's coming after the return of Jesus Christ to this earth. But what we have to sound the alarm about is all that's to happen before Jesus Christ sets foot on the Mount of Olives. I mean, what we're seeing right now are the beginning of sorrows, as Jesus said in Matthew 24. It's building to what Jesus said in Luke 21 about men's hearts failing them for fear and for looking after those things which are coming on the earth. It's a frightening time. If you didn't know God's truth, well, Satan still is just, it's amazing how distracted the world is to what is happening. But there is hope. There is hope for this dying world. And for those whose eyes are open to Bible prophecy, they understand this great hope represented by these fall festivals that we observe each year. My father concludes in this coworker letter, thank God we have been given eyes to see an understanding of what is happening around us. He quotes from 1 Corinthians 2 and verse 9, where it says that we have eyes to see and to understand. We can know And he says, finally, if we love God and if we have compassion for those suffering around us, then we will pour ourselves into his work. The relief we can offer this world has never been more necessary. Follow God's admonition and give generously to God's work, graciously and of a willing heart. If you do, you can know in faith that you have offered the most valuable assistance possible. That's from my father's latest coworker letter, dated September the 13th. And that's about all that we have time for on today's program. You're listening to Stephen Fleury, and this is the Trumpet Daily Radio Show. If you'd like to email the program, you can send feedback or comments, suggestions, whatever. You can send it to td@kpcg.fm. Thank you for joining us today. We'll see you tomorrow.